left hemisphere has ignored or suppressed, but shouldn't have. You are then alerted to this, and the left hemisphere is jolted into revising its narrative. The notion that many aspects of the human psyche might arise from a push-pull antagonism between complementary regions of the two hemispheres might seem like a gross oversimplification. Indeed, the theory itself might be the result of dichotomania, the brain's tendency to simplify the world by dividing things into polarized opposites, night and day, yin and yang, male and female, and so on. But it makes perfect sense from a systems engineering point of view. Control mechanisms that stabilize a system and help avoid oscillations are the rule rather than the exception in biology. I will now explain how the difference between coping styles of the two hemispheres accounts for anosognosia, the denial of disability, in this case, paralysis. As we saw earlier, when either hemisphere is damaged by stroke, the result is hemiplegia, a complete paralysis of one side of the body. If the stroke is in the left hemisphere, then the right side of the body is paralyzed, and, as expected, the patient will complain about the paralysis and request treatment. The same is true for a majority of right hemisphere strokes, but a significant minority of patients remain indifferent. They play down the extent of the paralysis and stubbornly deny that they cannot move, or even deny ownership of a paralyzed limb. Such denial usually happens as a result of additional damage to the postulated devil's advocate in the right hemisphere's frontoparietal regions, which allows the left hemisphere to go into an open loop, taking its denials to absurd limits. I recently examined an intelligent 60-year-old patient named Nora, who had an especially striking version of this syndrome. "Nora, how are you today?" I asked.
"Fine, sir, except the hospital food. It's terrible."
"Well, let's take a look at you. Can you walk?"
"Yes."
Actually, she hadn't taken a single step in the last week. "Nora, can you use your hands? Can you move them?"
"Yes."
"Both hands?"
"Yes."
Nora had not used a fork in a week. "Can you move your left hand?"
"Yes, of course."
"Touch my nose with your left hand." Nora's hand remains motionless. "Are you touching my nose?"
"Yes."
"Can you see your hand touching my nose?"
"Yes, it's now almost touching your nose."
A few minutes later, I grabbed Nora's lifeless left arm, raised it toward her face, and asked, "Whose hand is this, Nora?"
"That's my mother's hand, doctor."
"Where is your mother?" At this point, Nora looked puzzled and glanced around for her mother.
"She is hiding under the table."
"Nora, you said you can move your left hand?"
"Yes."
"Show me. Touch your own nose with your left hand." Without the slightest hesitation, Nora moved her right hand toward her flaccid left hand, grabbed it, and used it like a tool to touch her nose. The amazing implication is that even though she was denying that her left arm was paralyzed, she must have known at some level that it was, for if not, why would she spontaneously reach out to grab it? And why does she use her mother's left hand as a tool to touch her own nose? It would appear that there are many Noras within Nora. Nora's case is an extreme manifestation of anosognosia. More commonly, the patient tries to play down the paralysis rather than engaging in outright denial or confabulation. "No problem, doc. It's getting better every day." Over the years, I have seen many such patients and been struck by the fact that many of their comments bear a striking resemblance to the kinds of everyday denials and rationalizations that we all engage in to tide over the discrepancies in our daily lives. Sigmund, and more especially his daughter Anna Freud, refer to these as defense mechanisms, suggesting that their function is to protect the ego, whatever that means. Examples of such Freudian defenses would include denial, rationalization, confabulation, reaction formation, projection, intellectualization, and repression. These curious phenomena have only a tangential relevance to the problem of consciousness, with a big C, but, as Freud urged, they represent the dynamic interplay between the conscious and unconscious, so studying them may indirectly illuminate our understanding of consciousness and other related aspects of human nature. So I'll list them. 1. Outright denial. My arm isn't paralyzed. 2. Rationalization. The tendency we all have to ascribe some unpleasant fact about ourselves to an external cause. For example, we might say, "The exam was too hard," rather than, "I didn't study hard enough," or "The professor is sadistic," rather than, "I am not smart." This tendency is amplified in patients. For example, when I asked a patient, Mr. Dobbs, "Why are you not moving your left hand like I asked you to?" his replies varied. "I am an army officer, doctor. I don't take orders. The medical students have been testing me all day. I am tired. I have severe arthritis in my arm. It's too painful to move." 3. Confabulation. The tendency to make things up to protect your self-image. This is done unconsciously. There is no deliberate intention to deceive. "I can see my hand moving, doctor. It's an inch from your nose." 4. Reaction formation. The tendency to assert the opposite of what you unconsciously know to be true about yourself. Or, to paraphrase Hamlet, the tendency to protest too much. An example of this is closeted homosexuals engaging in vehement disapproval of same-sex marriages. Another example. I remember pointing to a heavy table in a stroke clinic and asking a patient whose left arm was paralyzed, "Can you lift that table with your right hand?" "Yes." "How high can you lift it?" "By about an inch." "Can you lift the table with your left hand?" "Yes, by 2 inches. Clearly, someone in there knew she was paralyzed, for if not, why would she exaggerate the arm's ability? 5. Projection. Ascribing your own deficiencies to another person. In the clinic, "The paralyzed arm belongs to my mother." In ordinary life, "He is a racist." 6. Intellectualization. Transforming an emotionally threatening fact into an intellectual problem, thereby deflecting attention from and blunting its emotional impact. Many a person with a terminally ill spouse or family member, unable to face the potential loss, starts treating the illness as a purely intellectual challenge. This could be regarded as a combination of denial and intellectualization, though the terminology is unimportant. 7. Repression. The tendency to block the retrieval of painful memories, which, if dredged up, would be painful to the ego. Although the word has made it into pop psychology, memory researchers have long been suspicious of repression. I lean toward thinking that the phenomenon is real, for I have seen many clear instances of it in my patients, providing what mathematicians call an existence proof. For example, most patients recover from anosognosia after having been in denial for a few days. I had been seeing one such patient who insisted for 9 days in a row that his paralyzed arm was working fine, even with repeated questioning. Then, on the 10th day, he recovered completely from his denial. When I questioned him about his condition, he immediately stated, "My left arm is paralyzed." "How long has it been paralyzed?" I asked, surprised. He replied, "Why, for the last several days that you have been seeing me." "What did you tell me when I asked you about your arm yesterday?" "I told you it was paralyzed, of course." Clearly, he was repressing his denials. Anosognosia is a striking illustration of what I have repeatedly stressed in this book, that belief is not a single thing. It has many layers that can be peeled away one at a time until the true self becomes nothing more than an airy abstraction. As the philosopher Daniel Dennett once said, the self is more akin conceptually to the center of gravity of a complicated object, its many vectors intersecting at a single imaginary point. Thus, anosognosia, far from being just another odd syndrome, gives us fresh insights into the human mind. Each time I see a patient with this disorder, I feel like I am looking at human nature through a magnifying glass. I can't help thinking that if Freud had known about anosognosia, he would have taken great delight in studying it. He might ask, for example, what determines which particular defense you use? Why use rationalization in some cases and outright denial for others? Does it depend entirely on the particular circumstances or on the patient's personality? Would Charlie always use rationalization and Joe use denial? Apart from explaining Freudian psychology in evolutionary terms, my model may also be relevant to bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness. There is an analogy between the coping styles of the left and right hemispheres, manic or delusional for the left, anxious devil's advocate for the right, and the mood swings of bipolar illness. If so, is it possible that such mood swings may actually result from alternation between the hemispheres? As my former teachers, Dr. Casey Nambiar and Jack Pettigrew, have shown, even in normal individuals, there may be some spontaneous flipping between the hemispheres and their corresponding cognitive styles. An extreme exaggeration of this oscillation may be regarded as dysfunctional or bipolar illness by psychiatrists, even though I have known some patients who are willing to tolerate the bouts of depression in order to, for example, continue their brief euphoric communions with God. Out-of-body experience. Doctor, I left my body behind. As we saw earlier, one job of the right hemispheres is to take a detached, big-picture view of yourself and your situation. This job also extends to allowing you to see yourself from an outsider's point of view. For example, when you are rehearsing a lecture, you may imagine watching yourself from the audience, pacing up and down the podium. This idea can also account for out-of-body experiences. Again, we only need to invoke disruption to the inhibitory circuits that ordinarily keep mirror neuron activity in check. Damage to the right frontoparietal regions, or anesthesia using the drug ketamine, which may influence the same circuits, removes this inhibition. As a result, you start leaving your body, even to the extent of not feeling your own pain. You see your pain objectively, as if someone else were experiencing it. Sometimes you get the feeling that you have actually left your body and are hovering over it, watching yourself from outside. Note that if these embodying circuits are especially vulnerable to lack of oxygen to the brain, this could also explain why such out-of-body sensations are common in near-death experiences. Odder still than most out-of-body sensations are the symptoms experienced by a patient named Patrick, a software engineer from Utah who had been diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor in his frontoparietal region. The tumor was on the right side of his brain, which was fortunate because he was less worried about it than he would have been had it been on the left. Patrick had been told he had less than 2 years to live, even after the tumor had been removed, but he tended to play it down. What really intrigued him was much stranger than either he or anyone else could have imagined. He noticed that he had an invisible but vividly felt phantom twin attached to the left side of his body. This was different from the more common sort of out-of-body experience in which a patient feels he is looking down on his own body from above. Patrick's twin mimicked his every action in near-perfect synchrony. Patients like him have been studied extensively by Peter Brueger of the University Hospital, Zurich. They remind us that even the congruence between different aspects of your mind, such as subjective ego and body image, can be deranged in brain disease. There must be a specific brain mechanism, or dovetailing suite of mechanisms, that ordinarily preserves such congruence. If there weren't, it could not have been affected selectively in Patrick, while leaving other aspects of his mind intact. For indeed, he was emotionally normal, introspective, intelligent,
and amiable. Out of curiosity, I irrigated his left ear canal with ice water. This procedure is known to activate the vestibular system and can provide a certain jolt to the body image. It can, for example, fleetingly restore awareness of the paralysis of the body to a patient with anosognosia due to a parietal stroke. When I did this for Patrick, he was astonished to notice the twin shrinking in size, moving, and changing posture. Ah, how little we know about the brain! Out-of-body experiences are seen often in neurology, but they blend imperceptibly into what we call dissociative states, which are usually seen by psychiatrists. The phrase refers to a condition in which the person mentally detaches herself from whatever is going on in her body during a highly traumatic experience. Defense lawyers often use the dissociative state diagnosis, that the accused was in such a state that she was watching her body acting out the murder without personal involvement. The dissociative state involves the deployment of some of the same neural structures already discussed, but in addition, two other structures, the hypothalamus and the anterior cingulate. Ordinarily, when confronted with a threat, two outputs flow out from the hypothalamus, a behavioral output, such as running away or fighting, and an emotional output, such as fear or aggression. We already mentioned the third output, autonomic arousal leading to sweating GSR, blood pressure, and heart rate elevation. The anterior cingulate is simultaneously active. It allows you to remain aroused and ever vigilant for new threats and new opportunities for fleeing. But the degree of threat determines the degree to which each of these three subsystems is engaged. When one is confronted with an extreme threat, it is sometimes best to lie still and do nothing at all. This could be regarded as a form of playing possum, shutting down both the behavioral and emotional output. The possum becomes completely still when a predator is so close that escape is no longer an option, and in fact, any attempt would only activate the carnivore's instinct to chase down fleeing prey. Nonetheless, the anterior cingulate remains powerfully engaged the whole time to preserve vigilance, just in case the predator isn't fooled or a quick escape route becomes available. A vestige of this possum reflex, or an exaptation of it, may manifest itself as dissociative states in humans in extreme emergencies. You shut down overt behavior, as well as emotions, and view yourself with objective detachment from your own pain or panic. This sometimes happens in rape, for example, where the woman gets into a paradoxical state. I was viewing myself being raped as a detached external observer might, feeling the pain, but not the agony. And there was no panic. The same thing must have occurred when the explorer David Livingstone was mauled by a lion, chewing his arm off. He felt no pain or fear. The ratio of activation among these circuits and interactions between them can also give rise to less extreme forms of dissociation in which action is not inhibited, but emotions are. We have dubbed this the James Bond reflex. His nerves of steel allow him to remain unperturbed by distracting emotions as he pursues and tackles the villain, or has sex with a woman without paying the penalty of love. Social embedding. The self defines itself in relation to its social environment. When that environment becomes incomprehensible, for example, when familiar people suddenly seem unfamiliar, or vice versa, the self can experience extreme distress or even feel that it is under threat. The misidentification syndromes. Doctor, that's not my mother. A person's brain creates a unified, internally consistent picture of his social world, a stage occupied by different selves like you and me. Seems like a banal statement, but when the self is deranged, you begin to realize there are specific brain mechanisms at work to clothe the self with a body and an identity. In Chapter 2,
I offered an explanation for the Capgras syndrome in terms of visual pathways 2 and 3 as they diverge from the fusiform gyrus, figures 9-1 and 9-2. If pathway 3, the so what stream, which evokes emotions, is compromised, while pathway 2, the what stream, which enables identification, remains intact, a patient can recall facts and memories about his nearest and dearest, in a word, he can recognize them, but jarringly, distressingly, he does not get the warm, fuzzy feelings that he should. The mismatch is either too painful or too bewildering to accept, so he embraces the delusion of an identical imposter. Going further down the path of delusion, he may say things like, "my other mother," or even assert that there are several mother-like beings. This is called duplication or reduplication. Now think about what happens when the Capgras scenario is reversed. Intact pathway 3, compromised pathway 2. The patient loses her ability to recognize faces. She becomes face blind, a condition called prosopagnosia. And yet her pure unconscious discrimination of people's faces continues to be carried out by her intact fusiform gyrus, which can still send signals down to her intact so-what stream, pathway 3, to her amygdala. As a result, she still responds emotionally to familiar faces. She gives a nice big GSR signal when seeing her mother, for example, even though she has no idea who she is looking at. Strangely, her brain and skin knows something that her mind is unaware of consciously. This was shown in an elegant series of experiments by Antonio Damasio. So you can think of the Capgras and prosopagnosia disorders as mirror images of each other, both structurally and in terms of clinical symptoms. To most of us, with our undamaged brains, it seems counterintuitive that identity, facts known about a person, should be segregated from familiarity, emotional reactions to a person. How can you recognize someone, yet not recognize her at the same time? You might get an inkling of what this is like if you think back to an occasion when you ran into an acquaintance somewhere completely out of context, such as an airport in a foreign country, and could not for the life of you remember who he was. You experienced familiarity with lack of identity. The fact that such dissociation can occur at all is proof that separate mechanisms are involved, and in such airport moments, you experience a miniature fleeting syndrome that is the converse of Capgras. The reason you don't experience this cognitive discrepancy as unpleasant, except briefly, as you buy time with small talk while racking your brain, is because such episodes do not last long. If this acquaintance continued to look strange all the time, irrespective of context, and no matter how much or how often you spoke with him, he might start looking sinister, and you might indeed develop a strong aversion or paranoia. Self-duplication. Doctor, where is the other David? Astonishingly, we have found that the reduplication seen in Capgras syndrome can even involve the patient's own self. As previously noted, the recursive activity of mirror neurons may result in a representation not only of others' minds, but of one's own mind as well. Some mix-up of this mechanism could explain why our patient David pointed to a profile view photo of himself and said, "That's another David." On other occasions, he referred to the other David in casual conversation, even asking poignantly, "Doctor, if the other David comes back, will my real parents disown me?" Of course, we all indulge in role-playing from time to time, but not to the point where the metaphorical, "I am in two minds, I am not the young man that I once was," becomes literal. Again, bear in mind that despite these specific dreamlike misreadings of reality, David was perfectly normal in other respects. I might add that the Queen of England also refers to herself in the third person, but would hesitate to ascribe this to pathology. Fragile syndrome. Doctor, everyone looks like Aunt Cindy. In Fregoli syndrome, the patient claims that all people seem to resemble a prototype person he knows. For example, I once met a man who said everyone looked like his Aunt Cindy. Perhaps this arises because the emotional pathway 3, as well as links from pathway 2 to amygdala, has been strengthened by disease. This could happen because of repeated volleys of signals accidentally activating pathway 3, as in epilepsy. It is sometimes called kindling. The outcome is that everyone looks strangely familiar rather than unfamiliar. Why the patient should latch on to a single prototype is unclear, but it may arise from the fact that diffuse familiarity makes no sense. By analogy, the diffuse anxiety of the hypochondriac seldom floats free for long, but latches on to a specific organ or disease. Self-awareness. Earlier in this chapter, I wrote that a self that is not aware of itself is an oxymoron. There are, nevertheless, certain disorders that can seriously distort one's self-awareness, whether by causing patients to believe that they are dead or by inspiring the delusion that they have become one with God. Cotard syndrome. Doctor, I don't exist. If you do a survey and ask people, whether neuroscientists or Eastern mystics, what the most important puzzling aspect of the self is, the most common answer would be the fact that the self is aware of itself. It can contemplate its own existence and, alas, its mortality. No non-human creature can do this. I often visit Chennai, India during the summer to give lectures and see patients at the Institute of Neurology on Mount Road. A colleague of mine, Dr. A.V. Santhanam, often invites me to lecture there and draws my attention to interesting cases. On one particular evening after giving a lecture, I found Dr. Santhanam waiting for me in my office with a patient, a disheveled, unshaven young man of 30 named Yusuf Ali. Ali had suffered from epilepsy starting in his late teens. He had periodic bouts of depression, but it was hard to know whether this was related to his seizures or to reading too much Sartre and Heidegger, as many intelligent teenagers do. Ali told me of his deep interest in philosophy. The fact that Ali was acting strangely was obvious to nearly everyone who knew him long before his epilepsy was diagnosed. His mother had noticed that a couple of times a week there were brief periods when he would become somewhat detached from the world, appear to experience a clouding of consciousness, and engage in incessant lip-smacking and postural contortions. This clinical history, together with his EEG, electroencephalograph, a record of his brain waves, led us to diagnose Ali's mini-seizures as a form of epilepsy called complex partial seizures. Such seizures are different from the dramatic grand mal whole-body seizures most people associate with epilepsy. These mini-seizures, in contrast, mainly affect the temporal lobes and produce emotional changes. During his long seizure-free intervals, Ali was perfectly lucid and intelligent. "What brings you to our hospital?" I asked. Ali remained silent, looking at me intently for nearly a minute. He then whispered slowly, "Not much can be done. I am a corpse."
"Ali, where are you?"
"At the Madras Medical College, I think. I used to be a patient at the Kilpauk."
Kilpauk was the only mental hospital in Chennai. "Are you saying you are dead?"
"Yes. I don't exist. You could say I am an empty shell. Sometimes I feel like a ghost that exists in another world."
"Mr. Ali, you are obviously an intelligent man. You are not mentally insane. You have abnormal electrical discharges in certain parts of your brain that can affect the way you think. That's why they moved you here from the mental hospital. There are certain drugs that are very effective for controlling seizures."
"I don't know what you are saying. You know the world is illusory, as the Hindus say. It's all Maya, the Sanskrit word for illusion. And if the world doesn't exist, then in what sense do I exist? We take all that for granted, but it simply isn't true."
"Ali, What are you saying? Are you saying you may not exist? How do you explain that you are here talking to me right now?
Ali appeared confused, and a tear started forming in his eye.
Well, I am dead and immortal at the same time.
In Ali's mind, as in the minds of many otherwise normal mystics, there is no essential contradiction in his statement. I sometimes wonder whether such patients who have temporal lobe epilepsy have access to another dimension of reality, a wormhole of sorts into a parallel universe, but I usually don't say this to my colleagues, lest they doubt my sanity.
Ali had one of the strangest disorders in neuropsychiatry, Cotard syndrome. It would be all too easy to jump to the conclusion that Ali's delusion was the result of extreme depression. Depression very often accompanies Cotard syndrome. However, depression alone cannot be the cause of it. On the one hand, less extreme forms of depersonalization, in which the patient feels like an empty shell, but unlike a Cotard patient, retains insight into his illness, can occur in the complete absence of depression. Conversely, most patients who are severely depressed don't go around claiming they are dead. So something else must be going on in Cotard syndrome.
Dr. Santhanam started Ali on a regimen of the anticonvulsant drug lamotrigine.
"This should help you get better," he said. "We are going to start you on a small dose because in a few rare cases, patients develop a very severe allergic skin rash. If you develop such a rash, stop the medicine immediately and come and see us."
Over the next few months, Ali's seizures disappeared, and as an added bonus, his mood swings diminished, and he became less depressed. Yet even 3 years later, he continued to maintain that he was dead. What could be causing this Kafkaesque disorder? As I noted earlier, pathways 1, including parts of the inferior parietal lobule, and 3, are both rich in mirror neurons. The former is involved in inferring intentions, and the latter, in concert with the insula, is involved in emotional empathy. You have also seen how mirror neurons might not only be involved in modeling other people's behavior, the conventional view, but may also turn inward to inspect your own mental states. This could enrich introspection and self-awareness. The explanation I propose is to think of Cotard syndrome as an extreme and more general form of Capgras syndrome. People with Cotard syndrome often lose interest in viewing art and listening to music, presumably because such stimuli also fail to evoke emotions. This is what we might expect if all or most sensory pathways to the amygdala are totally severed, as opposed to Capgras syndrome, in which just the face area in the fusiform gyrus is disconnected from the amygdala. Thus, for a Cotard patient, the entire sensory world, not just mom and dad, would seem derealized, unreal, as in a dream. If you added to this cocktail a derangement of reciprocal connections between the mirror neurons and the frontal lobe system, you would lose your sense of self as well. Lose yourself and lose the world. That's as close to death in life as you can get. No wonder severe depression frequently, though not always, accompanies Cotard syndrome. Note that in this framework, it is easy to see how a less extreme form of Cotard syndrome could underlie the peculiar states of derealization, the world looks unreal as in a dream, and depersonalization, I don't feel real, that are frequently seen in clinical depression. If depressed patients have selective damage to the circuits that mediate empathy and the salience of external objects, but intact circuitry for self-representation, the result could be derealization and a feeling of alienation from the world. Conversely, if self-representation is mainly affected, with normal reactions to the outside world and people, the sense of internal hollowness or emptiness that characterizes depersonalization would be the result. In short, the feeling of unreality is attributed to either oneself or the world,
depending on differential damage to these closely linked functions. The extreme sensory-emotional disconnection and diminishment of self I am proposing as an explanation for Cotard syndrome would also explain such patients' curious indifference to pain. They feel pain as a sensation, but, like Mickey, whom we met in Chapter 1, there is no agony. As a desperate attempt to restore the ability to feel something, anything, such patients may try to inflict pain on themselves in order to feel more anchored in their bodies. It would also explain the paradoxical finding, not proven but suggestive, that some severely depressed patients commit suicide when first put on antidepressant drugs such as Prozac. It is arguable that in extreme Cotard cases, suicide would be redundant, since the self is already dead. There is no one there who can or should be put out of their suffering. On the other hand, an antidepressant drug may restore just enough self-awareness for the patient to recognize that her life and world are meaningless. Now that it matters that the world is meaningless, suicide may seem the only escape. In this scheme, Cotard syndrome is apotemnophilia for one's entire self, rather than just one arm or leg, and suicide is its successful amputation. Doctor, I am one with God. Now consider what would happen if the extreme opposite were to occur, if there were a tremendous overactivation of pathway 3 caused by the kind of kindling one sees in temporal lobe epilepsy, TLE. The result would be an extreme heightening of empathy for others, for the self, and even for the inanimate world. The universe and everything in it becomes deeply significant. It would feel like union with God. This, too, is frequently reported in TLE. Now, as in Cotard syndrome, imagine adding into this cocktail some damage to the system in the frontal lobes that inhibits mirror neuron activity. Ordinarily, this system preserves empathy while preventing over-empathy, thus preserving your sense of identity. The result of damaging this system would be a second, even deeper sense of merging with everything. This sense of transcending your body and achieving union with some immortal, timeless essence is also unique to humans. To their credit, apes are not preoccupied with theology and religion. Doctor, I'm about to die. Incorrect attribution of our internal mental states to the wrong trigger in the external world is very much a part of the complex web of interactions that lead to mental illness in general. Cotard syndrome and merging with God are extreme forms of this. A far more common form is the syndrome of panic attacks. A certain proportion of otherwise normal people are seized for 40 to 60 seconds by a sudden feeling of impending doom, a sort of transient Cotard syndrome, combined with a strong emotional component. The heart starts beating faster, felt as palpitations and intensification of heartbeats, palms sweat, and there is an extreme sense of helplessness. Such attacks can occur several times a week. One possible source of panic attacks might be brief mini-seizures affecting pathway 3, especially the amygdala and its emotional and autonomic arousal outflow through the hypothalamus. In such a case, a powerful fight-or-flight reaction would be triggered, but since there is nothing external you can ascribe the changes to, you internalize it and start to feel as if you're dying. It's the brain's aversion to discrepancy again, this time between the neutral external input and the far-from-neutral internal physiological feelings. The only way your brain can account for this combination is to ascribe the changes to some indecipherable and terrifying internal source. The brain finds free-floating, inexplicable anxiety less tolerable than anxiety which can be clearly attributed to a source. If this is correct, one wonders if it might be possible to cure panic attacks by taking advantage of the fact that the patient often knows a few seconds ahead of time that an attack is about to occur. If you are a patient, then as soon as you sense the attack coming on, you would quickly start watching a horror movie on your iPhone, for example. This might abort the attack by allowing your brain to ascribe the physiological arousal to an external horror, rather than to some terrifying but intangible inner cause. The fact that you know that it's only a movie at some higher intellectual level doesn't necessarily rule out this treatment. After all, you do feel fear when watching a horror movie, even while recognizing that it's only a movie. Belief is not monolithic. It exists in many layers whose interactions one can manipulate clinically, using the right trick. Continuity. Implicit in the idea of the self is the notion of sequentially organized memories accumulated over a lifetime. There are syndromes that can profoundly affect different aspects of memory formation and retrieval. Psychologists classify memory, the word is used loosely synonymous with learning, into three distinct types that might have separate neural substrates. The first of these, called procedural memory, allows you to acquire new skills, such as riding a bicycle or brushing your teeth. Such memories are summoned up instantly when the occasion demands. No conscious recollection is involved. This type of memory is universal to all vertebrates and some invertebrates. It certainly isn't unique to humans. Second, there are memories that comprise your semantic memory, your factual knowledge of objects and events in the world. For example, you know that winter is cold and bananas are yellow. This form of memory, too, is not unique to humans. The third category, first recognized by Endel Tulving, is called episodic memory, memories for specific events, such as your prom night, or the day you broke your ankle playing basketball, or as the psycholinguist Steve Pinker puts it, when and where, who did what to whom. Semantic memories are like a dictionary, whereas episodic ones are like a diary. Psychologists also refer to them as knowing versus remembering. Only humans are capable of the latter. Harvard psychologist Dan Schachter has made the ingenious suggestion that episodic memories may be intimately linked to your sense of self. You need a self to which you attach the memories, and the memories in turn enrich yourself. In addition to this, we tend to organize episodic memories in approximately the correct sequence and can engage in a sort of mental time travel, conjuring them up in order to visit or relive episodes in our lives in vivid nostalgic detail. These abilities are almost certainly unique to humans. More paradoxical is our ability to engage in more open-ended forward time travel to anticipate and plan the future. This ability is probably also unique to us and may require well-developed frontal lobes. Without such planning, our ancestors couldn't have made stone tools in advance of a hunt or sown seeds for the next harvest. Chimpanzees and orangutans engage in opportunistic tool-making and tool use, stripping leaves from twigs in order to fish termites from their mounds, but they cannot make tools with the intent to store them for future use. Doctor, when and where did my mother die? All of this makes intuitive sense, but there is also evidence from brain disorders, some common, others rare, in which the different components of memory are selectively compromised. These syndromes vividly illustrate the different subsystems of memory, including ones that have evolved only in humans. Almost everyone has heard of amnesia following head trauma. The patient has difficulty recollecting specific incidents that took place during the weeks or months preceding the injury, even though he is smart, recognizes people, and is able to acquire new episodic memories. This syndrome, retrograde amnesia, is quite common, seen as often in real life as in Hollywood. Far rarer is a syndrome described by Endel Tulving, whose patient Jake had damage to parts of both his frontal and temporal lobes. As a result, Jake had no episodic memories of any kind, whether from childhood or from the recent past, nor could he form new episodic memories. However, his semantic memories about the world remained intact. He knew about cabbages, kings, love, hate, and infinity. It is very hard for us to imagine Jake's inner mental world. Yet despite what you would expect from Schachter's theory, there was no denying that he had a sense of self. The various attributes of self, it would seem, are like arrows pointing toward an imaginary point, the mental center of gravity of the self that I mentioned earlier. Losing any one arrow might impoverish the self, but does not destroy it. The self valiantly defies the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Even so, I would agree with Schachter that the autobiography we each carry around in our minds based on a lifetime of episodic memories is intimately linked to our sense of self. Tucked away in the lower inner portion of the temporal lobes is the hippocampus, a structure required for the acquisition of new episodes. When it is damaged on both sides of the brain, the result is a striking memory disorder called anterograde amnesia. Such patients are mentally alert, talkative, and intelligent, but cannot acquire any new episodic memories. If you were introduced to such a patient for the first time, walked out, and returned after 5 minutes, there would be no glimmer of recognition on her part. It's as if she had never seen you before. She could read the same detective novel again and again and never get bored. Yet, unlike Tolving's patient, her old memories, acquired prior to the damage, are for the most part intact. She remembers the boy she was dating in the year of her accident, her 40th birthday party, and so on. So you need your hippocampus to create new memories, but not to retrieve old memories. This suggests that memories are not actually stored in the hippocampus. Furthermore, the patient's semantic memories are unaffected. She still knows facts about people, history, word meanings, and so forth. A great deal of pioneering work has been done on these disorders by my colleagues Larry Squire and John Wickstead at UC San Diego, and by Brenda Milner at McGill University, Montreal. What would happen if someone were to lose both his semantic and episodic memories, so that he had neither factual knowledge of the world nor episodic memories of a lifetime? No such patient exists. And even if you were to stumble on one who had the right combination of brain lesions, what would you expect him to say about his sense of self? In fact, if he really had neither factual nor episodic memories, it is unlikely that he could even talk to you or understand your question, let alone understand the meaning of I. However, his motor skills would be unaffected. He might surprise you by cycling home. Free will. One attribute of the self is your sense of being in charge of your actions and, as a corollary, of your belief that you could have acted otherwise if you had chosen to. This may seem like an abstract philosophical issue, but it plays an important role in the criminal justice system. You can deem someone guilty only if he, 1, could fully envisage alternate courses of action available to him, 2, he was fully aware of the potential consequences of his actions, both short and long term, 3, he could have chosen to withhold the action, and 4, he wanted the result that ensued. The upper gyrus, branching from the left inferior parietal lobule, which I earlier referred to as the supramarginal gyrus, is very much involved in this ability to create a dynamic internal image of anticipated actions. This structure is highly evolved in humans. Damage to it results in a curious disorder called apraxia, defined as an inability to carry out skilled actions. For example, if you ask an apraxic patient to wave goodbye, she will simply stare at her hand and start wiggling her fingers. But if you ask her, "What does goodbye mean?" she will reply, "Well, you wave your hand when parting company." Furthermore, her hand and arm muscles are fine. She can untie a knot. Her thinking and language are unaffected, and so is her motor coordination, but she cannot translate thought into action. I have often wondered whether this gyrus, which exists only in humans, evolved initially for the manufacture and deployment of multi-component tools, such as hafting an axe head on a suitably carved handle. All of this is only part of the story. We usually think of free will as the drive to perform that is linked to your sense of being a purposeful agent with multiple choice options. We have only a few clues as to where this sense of agency, your desire to act, and belief in your ability, emerges from. Strong hints come from studying patients with damage to the anterior cingulate in the frontal lobes, which in turn gets a major input from the parietal lobes, including the supramarginal gyrus. Damage here can result in the akinetic mutism, or vigilant coma, we saw in Jason at the beginning of this chapter. A few patients recover after some weeks and say things like, "I was fully conscious and aware of what was going on, doctor. I understood all your questions, but I simply didn't want to reply or do anything." Wanting, it turns out, is crucially dependent on the anterior cingulate. Another consequence of damage to the anterior cingulate is the alien hand syndrome, in which the person's hand does something he doesn't will it to do. I saw a woman with this disorder in Oxford, together with Peter Halligan. The patient's left hand would reach out and grab objects without her intending to, and she had to use her right hand to pry loose her fingers to let go of the object. Some of the male graduate students in my lab have dubbed this the third date syndrome. Alien hand syndrome underscores the important role of the anterior cingulate in free will, transforming a philosophical problem into a neurological one. Philosophy has set up a way of looking at the consciousness problem by considering abstract questions such as qualia and their relationship to the self. Psychoanalysis, while able to frame the problem in terms of conscious and unconscious brain processes, hasn't formulated clearly testable theories, nor do they have the tools to test them. My goal in this chapter has been to demonstrate that neuroscience and neurology provide us with a new and unique opportunity to understand the structure and function of the self, not only from the outside by observing behavior, but also from studying the inner workings of the brain. By studying patients such as those in this chapter who have deficits and disturbances in the unity of self, we can gain deeper insight into what it means to be human. If we succeed in this, it will be the first time in evolution that a species has looked back on itself and not only understood its own origins, but also figured out what or who is the conscious agent doing the understanding. We don't know what the ultimate outcome of such a journey will be, but surely it is the greatest adventure humankind has ever embarked on. Epilogue. Gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. William Shakespeare. One of the major themes in the book, whether talking about body image, mirror neurons, language evolution, or autism, has been the question of how your inner self interacts with the world, including the social world, while at the same time maintaining its privacy. The curious reciprocity between self and others is especially well developed in humans and probably exists only in rudimentary form in the great apes. I have suggested that many types of mental illness may result from derangements in this equilibrium. Understanding such disorders may pave the way not only for solving the abstract, or should I say, philosophical problem of the self at a theoretical level, but also for treating mental illness. My goal has been to come up with a new framework to explain the self and its maladies. The ideas and observations I have presented will hopefully inspire new experiments and set the stage for a more coherent theory in the future. Like it or not, this is the way science often works in its early stage. Discover the lay of the land first, before attempting all-encompassing theories. Ironically, it's also the stage when science is most fun. Every little experiment you do, you feel like Darwin unearthing a new fossil or Richard Burton turning another bend of the Nile to discover its source. You may not share their lofty stature, but in trying to emulate their style, you feel their presence as guardian angels. To use an analogy from another discipline, We are now at the same stage that chemistry was in the 19th century, discovering the basic elements, grouping them into categories, and studying their interactions. We are still grouping our way toward the equivalent of the periodic table, but are not anywhere near atomic theory. Chemistry had many false leads, such as the postulation of a mysterious substance, phlogiston, which seemed to explain some chemical interactions, until it was discovered that to do so, phlogiston had to have a negative weight. Chemists also came up with spurious correlations. For example, John Newlands's Law of Octaves, which claimed that elements came in clusters of eight, like the eight notes in one octave of the familiar Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do scale of Western music. Though wrong, this idea paved the way for the periodic table. One hopes the self isn't like phlogiston. I started by outlining an evolutionary and anatomical framework for understanding many strange neuropsychiatric syndromes. I suggested that these disorders could be regarded as disturbances of consciousness and self-awareness, which are quintessentially human attributes. It's hard to imagine an ape suffering from Cotard syndrome or God delusions. Some of the disorders arise from the brain's attempts to deal with intolerable discrepancies among the outputs of different brain modules, as in Capgras syndrome and apotemnophilia, or inconsistencies between internal emotional states and a cognitive appraisal of the external circumstances, as in panic attacks. Other disorders arise from derangement of the normally harmonious interplay of self-awareness and other awareness that partly involves mirror neurons and their regulation by the frontal lobes. I began this book with Disraeli's rhetorical question, "Is man an ape or angel?" I discussed the clash between two Victorian scientists, Huxley and Owen, who argued over this issue for three decades. The former emphasized continuity between the brains of apes and humans, and the latter emphasized human uniqueness. With our increasing knowledge of the brain, we need not take sides on this issue anymore. In a sense, they were both right, depending on how you ask the question. Aesthetics exists in birds, bees, and butterflies, but the word art, with all its cultural connotations, is best applied to humans, even though, as we have seen, art taps into much of the same circuitry in us as in other animals. Humor is exclusively human, but laughter isn't. No one would ascribe humor to a hyena or even to an ape that laughs when tickled. Rudimentary imitation, such as opening a lock, can be also accomplished by orangutans, but imitation of more demanding skills, such as spearing an antelope or hafting a hand axe, and in the wake of such imitation, the rapid assimilation and spread of sophisticated culture, is seen only in humans. The kind of imitation humans do may have required, among other things, a more complexly evolved mirror neuron system than what exists in lower primates. A monkey can learn new things, of course, and retain memory, but a monkey cannot engage in conscious recollection of specific events from its past in order to construct an autobiography, imparting a sense of narrative and meaning to its life. Morality, and its necessary antecedent free will, in the sense of envisioning consequences and choosing among them, requires frontal lobe structures that embody values on the basis of which choices are made via the anterior cingulate. This trait is seen only in humans, although simpler forms of empathy are surely present in the great apes. Complex language, symbol juggling, abstract thought, metaphor, and self-awareness are all almost certainly unique to humans. I have offered some speculation on their evolutionary origins, and suggested also that these functions are mediated partly by specialized structures, such as the angular gyrus and Wernicke's area. The manufacture and deployment of multi-component tools intended for future use probably requires yet another uniquely human brain structure, the supramarginal gyrus, which branched off from its ancestor, the inferior parietal lobule, in apes. Self-awareness and the interchangeably used word consciousness has proved to be an especially elusive quarry, but we have seen how it can be approached through studying the inner mental life of neurological and psychiatric patients. Self-awareness is a trait that not only makes us human, but also paradoxically makes us want to be more than merely human. As I said in my BBC Wreath lectures, science tells us we are merely beasts, but we don't feel like that. We feel like angels trapped inside the bodies of beasts, forever craving transcendence. That's the essential human predicament, in a nutshell. We have seen that the self consists of many strands, each of which can be unraveled and studied by doing experiments. The stage is now set for understanding how these strands harmonize in our normal day-to-day consciousness. Moreover, treating at least some forms of mental illness as disorders of self might enrich our understanding of them and help us devise new therapies to complement traditional ones. The real drive to understand the self, though, comes not from the need to develop treatments, but from a more deep-seated urge that we all share, the desire to understand ourselves. Once self-awareness emerged through evolution, it was inevitable that an organism would ask, "Who am I?" Across vast stretches of inhospitable space and immeasurable time, there suddenly emerged a person called me, or I. Where does this person come from? Why here? Why now? You, who are made of stardust, are now standing on a cliff, gazing at the starlit sky, pondering your own origins and your place in the cosmos. Perhaps another human stood in that very same spot 50,000 years ago, asking the very same question. As the mystically inclined Nobel Prize-winning physicist Erwin Schrödinger once asked, was he really another person? We wander to our peril into metaphysics, but as human beings, we cannot avoid doing so. When informed that their conscious self emerges simply from the mindless agitations of atoms and molecules in their brains, people often feel let down, but they shouldn't. Many of the greatest physicists of this century, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, Wolfgang Pauli, Arthur Eddington, and James Jeans, have pointed out that the basic constituents of matter, such as quanta, are themselves deeply mysterious, if not downright spooky, with properties bordering on the metaphysical. So we need not fear that the self might be any less wonderful or awe-inspiring for being made of atoms. You can call this sense of awe and perpetual astonishment God, if you like. Charles Darwin himself was at times ambivalent about these issues. I feel most deeply that this whole question of creation is too profound for human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton. Let each man hope and believe what he can. And elsewhere, I own that I cannot see as plainly as others do, and as I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to me too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae, a family of parasitic wasps, with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice. On the other hand, I cannot anyhow be contented to view this wonderful universe, and especially the nature of man, and to conclude that everything is the result of brute force. These statements are pointedly directed against creationists, but Darwin's qualifying remarks are hardly the kind you would expect from the hardcore atheist he is often portrayed to be. As a scientist, I am one with Darwin, Gould, Pinker, and Dawkins. I have no patience with those who champion intelligent design, at least not in the sense that most people would use that phrase. No one who has watched a woman in labor or a dying child in a leukemia ward could possibly believe that the world was custom-crafted for our benefit. Yet, as human beings, we have to accept, with humility, that the question of ultimate origins will always remain with us, no matter how deeply we understand the brain and the cosmos that it creates. This concludes The Telltale Brain.